I can't be certain of this, but I think there are pretty good odds that I am the only rabbi in America who is beginning his first day Rosh Hashanah sermon with Gwyneth Paltrow. Because you see, as some of you know, I took a sabbatical this year, 3 months. I actually have 3 more months to go, so it will strike at some point. And when I was thinking about what I was going to do on my sabbatical, in addition to writing a book, I wrote a book about King David, which you'll hear about next year because that's when it'll be out. I remembered an interview that I saw with Gwyneth Paltrow a few years ago in which she said, "I will never forget that the first man who took me to Paris was my father." Well, I have a 16-year-old daughter. And I thought, I want her to say that about me. So I said, we're going to Paris. By the way, I got very little pushback on that. And we did, and we went, and it was wonderful. And we had a deal that I recommend to all of you who are bringing children to foreign countries. The deal was we have to go to the museum, but we stay only until one person wants to go. So you got to walk in the door, you got to walk around, but as soon as you say, I've had enough, I've seen everything the Louvre has to offer, we go. So we hit a lot of museums. I can't say we mastered all of them, but we saw many, including a whirlwind trip through Versailles. And then we went to the Jewish Museum. And as we went into the Jewish Museum, which has one of those doors that allows one person in, and then the door has to close, and the other one opens, and you walk in, and it closes. As the two of us got into the courtyard that separates the entrance from the museum, I said, Samara, did you notice with all the museums we've gone to, the only one that has security like that is this one? And she said, of course, Dad, it's the Jewish Museum. And it made me sad. Because already she knew that despite the fact that we went to museums that had treasures that were absolutely priceless, no other museum needed the security of the small Jewish museum. And it got me to thinking anew about something that I have thought about quite often, and then it was reinforced by a powerful article written by a French historian, Michel Gerfinkel, that was published online in Mosaic about a month ago called You Only Live Twice. And the idea behind it was that European Jewry had lived before the Second World War. Remember, if you include the Soviet Union, there were 10 million Jews in Europe. 10 million, more than America, more than Israel. And then there was the wholesale destruction of European Jewry. But then he said, you know, after the Second World War, there was something of a resurgence. But now, through many factors, primary among them anti-Semitism from the left and the right, now he said, European Jewry is beginning to think that you only get to live twice, and then it's over. And so even though I, like you, care for and support organizations that help resurgent life in the former Soviet Union and in Europe, seeing this and having that experience made me wonder anew a question to which there is no certain answer, but to which I think we ought to look for an answer, which is, why are we still here? It never goes away, the attempt to push the Jews out. Why are we still here? The most thoughtless and least legitimate answer is we're here because of persecution. Having millions of your people killed is no assurance of survival. Not only that, but let me let you in on a little secret. Many, many, many peoples throughout history have been persecuted. The reason you can't name them is because they're not here anymore. Most hated, persecuted, fought against people do what you're supposed to do, which is disappear. But we haven't. And I wonder why. Maurice Samuel used to say, the reason the Jews haven't disappeared is because we decided we weren't going to leave this world until we figured it out. And we're still working on it. And then there will be people who will tell you that the reason we haven't disappeared is because God ensures our survival. But even if you believe that God ensures the survival, I still want to know the mechanism. What is it that God uses to ensure that we will still be here? And I actually have a theory for you. I think the reason the Jews are still here is because of what our tradition calls Ahavat Yisrael. The Jewish love of the Jewish people. Now, this may not at first strike you as so obvious. If, say, you came today through the parking lot, you might not think that Jewish love for one another is one of our defining traits. And let me tell you, by the way, earlier this year, I went to a mega church when Rick Warren, who has been a friend when he lost his son to suicide, and he and his wife were away for several months, and then they came back for the first Sunday morning. I and a friend of mine who was a rabbi, and also Ron Wolfson from the AJU, we all went to show support for him. And it was the first time that I had gone there, and thousands of people stream into that church on a Sunday morning, and nobody cuts in front of anyone else. And nobody screams. And everybody, they have greeters and they all have smiles. And nobody tried to find a space that wasn't entirely legal but was close. Except for me. I thought, wow, this is great. None of these people know that all you have to do is cut in there and go over there. But then I remembered I had a kippah on, and I took it easy, because, you know. But here's the thing. The deep thing, and this is not a commentary, obviously, on anybody who attended that church, but in general, here's the thing. When the Soviet Union was persecuting Jews, they were also persecuting Christians. But there was no worldwide Christian move to liberate Christians from the Soviet Union. But Jews would not rest. Right now in the Middle East, in many of the Muslim lands, Christians are being persecuted. But you don't hear about it. But let me tell you, if it was Jews, you'd hear about it every day, every single day. That's what I mean by Ahavat Yisrael. I mean that we look out for one another, we care about one another, and that's love. We're a religious family, and families fight. They're not always nice to each other. I remember Joseph Telushkin telling me that his mother used to tell him when he was a kid, the only happy families I know are families that I don't know very well. And it may be a slight exaggeration when the writer Joseph Epstein says, a sad Jew is a happy Jew. It's true that we have an affinity for infighting and for struggles, but even in our struggles, we love. I'm going to take the people of Sinai Temple, I'm going to take you as typical Jews. Granted, you're smarter and better looking, but otherwise typical. I want you to know that in the 16 years I've been the rabbi of this congregation, I have innumerable times called many of you and said, I need help for a Jew who can't pay rent or who doesn't have food. And I have never had someone say, don't call me, I don't care about Jews. Never. That's just not what we do. And it doesn't make it easy. Part of it is inbred and part of it is trained. It is what our rabbis call both the covenant of history, everything we have shared together. Because all of us, in different ways, have a shared history, and you have to have that history in order to be part of the Jewish people. It's why Maimonides, when a convert wrote him and said, may I say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is my God, he said, absolutely, you must say it. Because once you join the Jewish people, you join our history. We went through it together, all of us. But there is another covenant. There's a covenant of destiny. There's not only where we've been, but where we're going. And those covenants are held together by love, nothing else. The outgoing chief rabbi of Britain, Jonathan Sacks, says about the Jewish tradition, by making extraordinary demands, it inspires people to lead extraordinary lives. It's not easy. But it's not supposed to be easy. And yet, all of you know that it is not just hubris, and it is not just self-puffery, and it isn't just making ourselves feel good to say that we belong to a remarkable people. Just think of the artists and musicians and writers and business leaders and thinkers and philosophers in vastly disproportionate number. I don't have to tell you, I'm sure you get the emails about how many Nobel Prizes we win each year. But that's not the great measure of a remarkable people. Think of the mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. Think of the way you look in the newspaper to see if the person who has accomplished is Jewish, to feel proud, or if the person who has failed is Jewish, to feel ashamed. Maybe it's foolish, but it's a mark of love. We are implicated in everything that our people does because we have Ahavat Yisrael, love of the Jewish people. And that means every time there is a real threat, we mobilize. That's just what we do. It's not a love without bite. It's not an anodyne and easy love. It's a love that struggles and fights and argues, God, how we argue. But we also embrace. And we learned it from our best teachers. Remember that when God sees that the children of Israel are worshiping the golden calf, what God says to Moses is, I'm done with them. I'm through. Moses, I'm going to make you into the Jewish people. Just you, your line, your children, you're going to be it. And Moses says to God, if you destroy those people, Mecheni na misifracha asher katavta. Wipe me out of the book that you've written. I want no part of it if they're not a part of it. In other words, what saved Israel at that moment, it wasn't God's love, it was Moses' love. It was Ahavat Yisrael. It was the love of one Jew for another Jew, even though he was angry. He smashed the tablets, but he still loved them. He didn't like them, but he loved them. And when God comes to Moses and says, you're going to die, you don't get to see the promised land, it's over for you. What does Moses say? The first thing he says, God, appoint a leader. I don't want the people to be like a sheep that has no shepherd. That's love. His first thought is not for his end, but for the future of the people. I know it's not always easy. How many times have you or people you know have gone to Israel? You make the mistake of trying to get on a bus, and you get pushed and you get yelled at, and people go like this to you. I only included a hand gesture, by the way, for the people who listen on tape and don't come to synagogue. They should know they missed something. But we don't have to like each other all the time. We just have to love each other. You know, there are a couple of reasons, but one primary reason why the rabbis say that Elijah is supposed to come to a Brit Milah. Yeah, we sometimes say it's because each child might be the Messiah, but, you know, that's... Even for us proud parents, that's pushing it a little bit. No, it's because of what happens in Elijah's life. Elijah is the prophet when the Jewish people start worshiping Baal, an idol. And he tries to get them to worship God, and to make a long story short, as a result, Jezebel, who is the queen at the time, decrees death on him, and he's fed up with the Jewish people, and he runs away, and he goes into the forest. And then he goes to the mountain, and he's all by himself. And he's sick, and he wants to die. And the first thing that happens is an angel appears to him, a Jewish angel. I'm not being chauvinistic here. I'm sure there are some angels who are not Jewish. This one was Jewish. I'll prove it to you. You know what he says to Elijah? He says, Elijah, eat something. As the philosophers say, QED. And we know Elijah's Jewish because he eats something, he feels better. And then he goes to the mountain, and it is a famous scene, and I want to read to you exactly what it says. Then the word of the Lord came to him. He said, why are you here, Elijah? He replied, I am moved by zeal for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant. Hey, fair et britecha, azvu britecha. They've forsaken your covenant. So God says to him, every time the Israelites enact the covenant, I want you to be there. Because you indicted my people. You said they forsook the covenant. I'm going to prove to you you're wrong. Then Elijah goes on. They've torn down your altars and put your prophets to the sword. I alone am left, and they're out to take my life. Come out, says God. Stand on the mountain. And then there is a very famous scene. The Lord passed by. There was a great and mighty wind splitting mountains and shattering rocks, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice, a kol demama daka, which can also mean the thin voice of silence. But what does God say to Elijah in that thin voice? He says, why are you here, Elijah? And Elijah repeats himself. He says, I'm moved by zeal for the Lord of hosts. In other words, I care about you, God. For the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, put your prophets to the sword. I alone am left, and they are out to take my life. And you know what God says to him? Go back. Go back. I don't need a prophet in the wilderness. Lech shuv, return to the people. We don't believe in holy men on mountaintops because it doesn't show Ahavat Yisrael, love of real human beings. Real people, the ones that cause friction and fights and disagreements and trouble. Real people who have convictions completely different from you and still are your sisters and brothers. Real people who are dressed in black hats and payas and don't think that your worship is legitimate, and real people who are dressed today in shorts and at the beach and don't think that your God is real. But they're all Israel. All of them. Now, it is true that Ahavat Yisrael doesn't preclude Ahavat Olam, love of the world. In fact, just this week, a survey was released that proved what rabbis have said for a long time, which is that people who give more to the Jewish community give more to the general community as well. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not either or. Love of Israel does not preclude love of the world. In fact, it teaches it. But that's not why we're here. That's not why we survived. We didn't survive because we loved all human beings. We survived because we took care of one another. Because we loved one another. Because we realized that we were a family and that we couldn't make it alone. I went into a lot of museums in France with my daughter, but only in one did I feel like the person who had let me in was part of my family. When I looked at the security and made a face, she made a face right back, like, yeah, I know. Isn't it a shame? We understand. Hayom harat olam. Today the world was created, and it is a difficult world in some ways, but also for us, a beautiful one. Because look around you. Really, look around you. You see these people? I'm going to tell you something about them that you may not know. If you're in trouble, they will be there. If Israel's in trouble, they will be there. Around you is the Jewish people. We made it through the wilderness by holding one another's hand. As the new year begins, remember, never let go. Shana Tova.